In the words of Martin Luther King, please come in, make yourself at home. In the words of Martin Luther King, nothing in all the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. The true neighbor will risk his position, his prestige, and even his life for the welfare of others. The means by which we live have outdistanced the ends for which we live. Our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. We have guided missiles and misguided men. Freedom is never voluntarily given up by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. I believe that the unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. This is why right, temporarily defeated, is stronger than evil triumphant. Our destiny is tied up with the American destiny. Please take a moment to greet each other and welcome each other into this space. I welcome everybody to this celebration of Martin Luther King's life at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. May the spirit of life before it, we come into each other's presence this day to seek a part of ourselves, knowing that we do not live alone and knowing we cannot live fully if we are for ourselves alone. We gather in thanks for the life and ministry of Martin Luther King Jr., not to worship a saint, but because we wish to embody his dream as a possibility we make real. We gather with the knowledge of our shortcomings. Our lives set before us many tasks, and often we are not equal to them. We fall short of our expectations. We find we do not know enough. We are not always patient. We fall into anger. We cannot find the strength. We lack the vision. We wait in vain for wisdom. It is painful to acknowledge our shortcomings. Yet we are here, Spirit of Life. We are here, not always perfect, not always wise, not always just, but wonderfully and mysteriously human and alive. We dedicate this time together to renewing our hope. May the stories we share give us courage. May the songs we sing give us hope. May the words we speak lead us to wisdom. And most of all, may the touch of the hands, the sight of the faces, the sound of voices lifted in song and affirmation restore in us faith that this world may be made whole with all its people one.
Good morning, everyone. This is a poem that I wrote titled Pledge of Peace. I will coexist, share the world with others, friends, family, strangers, regardless of who other people think they are, what they do, what they cannot do, what they wish to become, what they have or do not have, what they look like, where they are from, or who they love. I will respect others. Some agree with my opinions and way of life, while others choose a different path for themselves. They are free to do so. I will do nothing to impede their chosen path or inhibit their successes, although their dreams may be different than mine. I have an individual responsibility to take care of myself, my loved ones, and my community without harming or inhibiting the success of people around me. And my world, which in turn cares for me, is that which within peace thrives. I will accept you for you.
I'd like to draw your attention to the announcements in our order of service, and we have an insert for the Chili Fiesta. I think this would be a great thing for everyone here to attend, so please fill this out and give it to Elka. Elka, raise your hand. All right. Now let us stand as you are able and sing our opening hymn, number 149, Lift Every Voice and Sing.
Thank you.
Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and our sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community. If you would like, please share a brief verbal expression of a special joy or sorrow.
Hi, I'm Angela. I actually have two. One, I'm actually able to be here this morning. And on the 12th of this month, we celebrated our twins' first birthday. That was quite of an experience.
Kim Bellinger. I have a joy that last week I started a new part-time job. I'm working at the Manhattan Arts Center as the Director of Education and Marketing. So that's pretty exciting. And I'm still a photographer also, just in case you're wondering. And this week was really exciting because my first full week there, it was the children's production from the Missoula Children's Theater of A Secret Garden, and five of our UU children were cast in it. So, can I say their names? Burke and Indigo and Connor and Rose and Maeve were all in the play, and it went yesterday, and it was amazing. So, good job.
May we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, and those we hold in silence in our hearts.
Many of you know, but not all of you, that we are preparing to do a joint concert with the First Congregational Choir on March the 3rd, and the two songs we're singing today are two of the 12 that will be part of that concert.
Every time I feel the Spirit moving in my heart, I will pray. It's now time for the story of all eight, for all ages, so any kids or kids at heart are welcome to come on up, and we're going to talk a little bit. Good morning. Tomorrow is, hi Maya, come on over. You going to sit next to me? Tomorrow is a day off from school for a lot of you. Who gets a day off tomorrow? Yeah. Do you know, I don't have to go to work either. That's kind of cool. Do you know why you have a day off?
Martin Luther King Day.
Martin Luther King Jr. Day. That's right, Ronan. It's his birthday. We're celebrating his birthday. Mm-hmm. Rose?
I learned about Martin Luther King in my class.
Yeah, everybody's probably learning a lot about him. Many people would say that Martin Luther King Jr. inspired us all to treat people with respect and to be better people ourselves inside. Do you know what that means, to be inspired? Did I say that? He inspires people? Do you have any idea what that might be, to inspire someone? Rose?
Surprise.
Surprise. Yeah, that works.
Treat
with good. Uh-huh. Connor?
To, like, give ideas. That's what inspires might mean.
Uh-huh. To give ideas to people. You guys have anything? No? Yes, absolutely. To be inspired, it kind of makes you think, yeah, I could do that. Or have you guys ever heard of something called Pinterest? On the internet, you know about Pinterest. I look at the pictures on Pinterest, and that inspires me. But it also kind of doesn't sometimes. Has anybody ever inspired you? Can you think of? You know, sometimes my kids, like Lily and my other kids, will fix dinner, and I'm inspired to wash dishes because the grown-ups really understand that when they laughed. Yes, Rose.
I got inspired. Maeve inspired me because she made something off from Pinterest for our dad's present for Christmas. Oh. It's a shirt. You kind of use spray paint, yeah. I think.
So what did that inspire you to do? Did that just make you feel good, that kind of inspiration, or did it inspire you to do something? It just was cool. Yeah, yeah. So sometimes it inspires me when I see you kids doing good things for each other. In fact, always it inspires me, not just sometimes, it always inspires me. What kinds of things do you do in your classrooms here that help other kids? Uh-huh.
When someone needs help, like when we were making something for the birds, there was like a big jumble of stuff, and the younger kids needed help from the older kids, like putting the popcorn and nuts through the other thing.
Yeah, I remember that. When we laced and made the strings, and that was really hard. I hurt my finger poking those holes, and that was really difficult, and it was really great when all you kids helped each other. Last week, my daughter Lily came home. Well, maybe it's been a couple weeks. Came home from school. Yeah, Kaya.
When we made those strings of popcorn and nuts for the birds, some of us put goldfish on them.
The goldfish crackers, not real goldfish, right? Yeah, yeah. Well, because birds like to eat. Maybe they would be tricked and think that they were real fish, and birds would like to eat that, huh? That's kind of good. That was smart. Last week or two, my daughter Lily came home from school, and she had a T-shirt that said, it had words on it that made me think about, it had a message on it. And it made me think about that there were things out there that I could remember to be a good person and to help. And I convinced Lily to wear the T-shirt. Do you think she should stand up and show it to everybody? Yes. So show everybody the front out there
oh, look, it's just a regular T-shirt. But let's look. You stand up front and let us see the back. You see the back? Can you see what it says? Hold your arms out. And move your ponytail. She inspires me. Can you guys see what the words are? Okay, now. Believe there is good in the world. Okay, now. Now turn around. Turn around and show the grown-ups. That's the shirt. It says, believe there is good in the world. But now turn back around. And Ronan saw there's another message in there. Do you see what that other message is, Ronan? You want to say it really loud?
Be the good.
It says, be the good. See how it says, believe there is good in the world. And then it says, it uses some of the letters, and it colored them in different. It says, be the good. They're highlighted. That's right, Connor. Okay, you can turn around and show the grown-ups again. So, do you guys have any ideas about that? Be the good? What do you think that means?
It means, like, let's say someone got hurt, and you wanted to help them, and you did. That's being good.
That's right. That's a great example. Anybody else have an example they want to share?
Like, if there's, like, a little kid, and there's this high table, and we're, like, crafting something, that we're making a little craft project, and they can't reach it. One of the bigger kids that are taller that can, like, reach it for them and give it to them so they can, like, have that supply for the craft.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's
not exactly, because if, let's say,
she has her opinion, you guys. Those grown-ups, they sometimes laugh at bad times.
Some kids can't use those things because, you know, Little kids like my brother, Arthur, that lives in the nursery, he can't use sharp things like needles like the other kids.
That's right. So
that's why we shouldn't give those things, but don't give them to really young people that can't use them.
That's right, because they're too young. And that makes a lot of sense both ways. That's part of being the good. Helping when you know, because you know how to help kids that need help. But you also know when it's smart to maybe not give those sharp things to those kids. And that's the same sort of thing as being the good. Kaya?
You don't want to give little kids little small things because they could swallow it and choke on it.
That's right. Absolutely. Rose, did you have something you wanted to share? Maybe later, okay? You can share it in class, too. Well, so it reminds me that the phrase, be the good, reminds me that not only can I be inspired by others and other things, but that maybe my actions could inspire others. Yeah, isn't that cool? So maybe if I wash the dishes tonight, then Lily might be inspired to cook dinner tomorrow night, too, for instance. Or, you know, other stuff. So, yes, you guys saw these. I have stickers here for each of you to wear. Okay, so you can just peel off one of them like this, but just peel off one. Let's just wear one, because then I'm going to have you hand these out. You can help the younger kids, okay? Then I'm going to have you hand these out to all the grown-ups. You can take a strip of stickers, and when we leave, you can hand it to the grown-up at the end of the aisle, and then all the grown-ups can pass them around each other, and they can have a sticker that says this, too, believe there is good in the world. And then they can put all the trash in the collection baskets, and I'll pick it up later. And the leftovers. And you can give yours to your parents. That's a great idea. Anybody else need one? Okay. All right. So as we leave, we're going to hand these out to everybody and think about being good. Give them a whole strip, okay? All right. That's a great idea. Everybody take a strip so you have a strip to hand out as you go. Okay, that's fine. And if there's leftovers, we'll pick them up afterwards. Okay, are you ready, Maya? Oh, that's okay. All right, go.
May the spirit of love surround you everywhere you may be.
This morning's offertory is Harmony Club Waltz by Scott Joplin, and we are blessed to have Slava Mir's student, Renee Hawley, who will be playing with us on many of the coming Sundays. So thank you, Renee. We give thanks for the needs of our community that reminds us of our common humanity, that help us grow into the compassion, the vision, and the promise of Martin Luther King. We give thanks for the needs of our hearts that foster our commitment to share our lives and goods. May we give mindfully so that the gifts we share may help all those in need of love. Thank you. On March 31st, 1968, Martin Luther King gave a service at the National Cathedral in Washington, and I'd like to read from that. The one thing that we usually remember about Rip Van Winkle's story is that he slept for 20 years. But there is another point in that little story that is almost completely overlooked. It was a sign in the end from which Rip went up in the mountain for his long sleep. When Rip Van Winkle went up into the mountain, the sign had a picture of King George III of England on it. When he came down 20 years later, the sign had a picture of George Washington, the President of the United States. When Rip Van Winkle looked up at the picture of George Washington, and looking at the picture, he was amazed. He was completely lost. He knew not who he was. And this reveals to us that the most striking thing about the story of Rip Van Winkle is not merely that Rip Van Winkle slept 20 years, but that he slept through a revolution. While he was peacefully snoring up in the mountain, a revolution was taking place that at points would change the course of history. And Rip knew nothing about it. He was asleep. Yes, he slept through the revolution. And one of the great liabilities of life is that we all too many times find ourselves living amidst of a great period of social change, and yet they fail to develop the new attitudes, the new mental responses, the new situation demands. They end up sleeping through a revolution. There can be no gainsaying of the fact that a great revolution is taking place in the world today. In a sense, it is a triple revolution. That is a technological revolution. Now, this is Martin Luther King saying this in 1968. That is a technological revolution with the impact of automation and cyber nation. Then there is a revolution in weaponry, when the emergence of atomic and nuclear weapons of warfare. Then there is human rights revolution, with the freedom explosion that is taking place all over the world. Yes, we do live in a period where changes are taking place. And there is still the voice crying through the vista of time saying, "Behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away." Richard Rohr, a Franciscan priest who's written many books, claims that 90% of us, 90% of the time, are operating on cruise control. So he suggests, and I think Martin Luther King and his life calls us to do, is to listen, to pay attention, to know that things are happening that we are a part of so that we can change our attitudes and be flowing with the good of the times and not be sleeping at the wheel. When Thomas Jefferson wrote, "All men are created equal," he believed that the slave trade to be an execrable commerce, the assemblage of horrors, a cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberties. The force of this idea that all men are created equal caused Massachusetts, the birthplace of Unitarianism, American Unitarianism, to grant freedom to their slaves. And the writing of the constitutions of six of the southern states, the state constitutions, they amended all men to all free men. According to historian David Bryan Davis, one cannot question the genuineness of Jefferson's liberal dreams. He was one of the first statesmen in any part of the world to advocate concrete measures for restricting and eradicating Negro slavery. But Davis goes on to say that in the 1790s, the most remarkable thing about Jefferson's stand on slavery is his immense silence. His immense silence. By the time of Jefferson's presidency and had returned to Monticello, his emancipation efforts had ceased. And the decade after the Revolutionary War, Jefferson's position on slavery had already transformed. I, like many people, would love to believe that Jefferson is just this noble, great man. Yes, he had slaves, but he treated them benevolently. But the truth is much uglier than the stories that the history books have told us. Much uglier. Over a decade ago, I remember taking a dear friend of mine to Monticello because I have always loved this place. It's such a grand and beautiful and inventive place. There's the dumbwaiters, and everything is beautiful as you walk up this hill, and it's just elegant, and the gardens are tremendous. But this time, as we stood in the dining room, and I looked at the dumbwaiter, and then I thought, okay, where does this go to? And you really have to go downstairs in a way that is totally hidden. You can't see this. There is a long corridor, I don't know how many yards, maybe 100, that goes to the kitchen. And the slaves would bring, he had 16 slaves that were devoted just to taking care of house guests, would carry all of this food back and forth, but never were they seen. Would come up the dumbwaiter and go down the dumbwaiter. Jefferson, his home was a well-managed industry with blacksmiths, coopers, nail makers, a brewer, cooks, professionally trained in French cuisine, a glazier, painters, millers, weavers, and farm workers. The efficient running of Monticello relied on slaves. Jefferson owned over 600 in his lifetime. It took 16 slaves, as I said, to care for his house guests. In 1817, he had 140 slaves. Historians until the last few decades tried to gloss over the harsh reality that allowed Jefferson to live so elegantly. As late as the 1960s, biographies of Jefferson portrayed him as the benevolent slave owner. A rural ideal was painted. No one argued, no one was whipped, everyone sang happily. There was an easygoing quality to the narrative. This was the best place they could be if they couldn't be free. At some point before he became president, there is a note in his accounts, he loved accounts, which calculates the value of his slaves. He found that he was making a 4% profit on the birth of black children, some of which were his own. This percentage was predictable. Jefferson came to understand that slavery was an investment strategy. He writes that an acquaintance who had suffered financial misfortune should have been invested in Negroes. Jefferson shared his 4% strategy with George Washington, who disagreed with him. He freed his slaves because its institution disgusted him. As an economist, Jefferson was right. Davis notes in 1860 the value of Southern slaves was about three times the amount invested in the entire United States in manufacturing or railroads. Three times. Having slaves made Jefferson a wealthy man. It was critical to his financial solvency and the success of the Southern economy. Jefferson's slave community was segregated and hierarchical. Most of the slaves were laborers. The next class were the enslaved artisans. Managers were in a station above them. The household staff was above them, not only because they were the most well-fed and clothed, but because they lived on the mountaintop. The rest of the slaves on Mulberry Lane were out of sight, kept well out of sight. A few of the slaves received gratuities. This favoritism bred resentment amongst the various classes. In the 1950s, historian Edwin Betts was editing material for Jefferson's Plantation Farm Book. He deliberately chose not to include that the nail factory, which employed a dozen slave boys between the ages of 10 and 16, working long and hard days in that smoke and heat-filled room, were not whipped. The absence of this important and telling fact shaped all the other historians' view of how Jefferson treated the slaves at Monticello. The fact is that he needed overseers who could whip those young boys daily so that he could make $2,000 a year from his nail factory. His competition was the penitentiary. In 1817, a Revolutionary War hero, Thaddeus Kosciuszko, a Polish nobleman and a good friend of Jefferson's, died. Thaddeus left a substantial fortune to Jefferson. Part of the funds were given to Jefferson so that he could free his slaves, buy them land and farming equipment. He was present and was the person who helped him write this will. But when he was offered this legacy, he refused. He did not want to lose his skilled labor force. He did not want to lose the income of making money off of Negro babies. Even though he was given the means to free these slaves, he chose not to. In 1790s, Jefferson mortgaged his slaves to a large Dutch bank so he could build the beautiful Monticello. George Washington did what he needed to do to emancipate his slaves, which he did in his will. He proved that it was practical and possible, which shines an entirely different light on the choices that Jefferson made. Washington also didn't believe that African Americans were inferior or should return to Africa, as did Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln. When Jefferson died, only a few of his slaves were freed. One of them, Joseph Fawcett, a blacksmith, watched his wife and his seven children, one of them who was born in the White House, sold on an auction block. He worked endlessly until he had the money to buy back his wife and children, but was only able to buy his wife, his son, Peter, and two daughters. They moved to Ohio in 1840. In 1898, when Peter, his son, was 83 years old, he recounted that he had never forgotten the moment when he was put on the auction block and sold like a horse. What do we do with the horror of these truths? Can you or I walk in Peter's shoes? Or his father Joseph or his wife's? How about Sally Hemings, who bore 7 of Jefferson's children? She was a slave owned by Thomas Jefferson, inherited through his wife, Martha Whale Skeleton Jefferson, when her father died. Sally's mother, Betsy, or Betty, was said to be the daughter of a black slave woman and a white ship captain. Betsy's children were said to have been fathered by her owner, John Wales, making Sally a half-sister to Jefferson's wife. I thought for many years that I bore no responsibility for this legacy and its outcome because all of my great-grandparents were living in Sweden or in Russia, except for one. They came over in the 1860s, and 2 of my great-great uncles enlisted in the Union forces to fight the Civil War for the keeping the Union whole. One of them died as a result of those wounds. We put flowers on Axtell's grave every Memorial Day. So I thought I didn't have anything to do with this. Why should I inherit this horrible guilt? Let me refer to the sermon that I started to quote from earlier, by Martin Luther King. In a sermon which begins with this tale of Rip Van Winkle, he goes on to examine the many challenges our country faced in 1968. They seem to be as relevant today as they were 40 years ago. First, he challenges us to develop a world perspective. He says, through our scientific and technical genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood, and yet we have not had the ethical commitment to make it into a brotherhood. But somehow and in some way, we will have got to do this. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will perish together as fools. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. And whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. We are tied together in this single garment. And whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Without this sense of connection, we cannot work on his second point, which he says, this country is challenged to eradicate the last vestiges of racial injustice from our nation. Racial injustice is still the black man's burden and the white man's shame. He says, it is an unhappy truth that racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white Americans, spoken and unspoken, acknowledged and denied, subtle and sometimes not so subtle. The disease of racism permeates and poisons a whole body politic, and I can see nothing more urgent than for Americans to work passionately and unrelentingly to get rid of the disease of racism. So, here we're at that point where how do you feel good about this? Well, you can say there have been many things that have happened in those 43 years since he gave this service, right? And there are many changes. But if you scratch beneath the surface, you will find that in some ways it is worse today than it was 43 years ago. I called my cousin Anna yesterday, who has worked for almost 2 decades in the south side of Chicago in the school system. She works in the Englewood neighborhood, which I believe you know very well because you grew up there, but is now one of the very toughest, most crime-ridden neighborhoods in Chicago. She said that between 14 and 18 kids between ages of 10 and 18 are killed every week. Every week. So when Sandy Hook and that great tragedy that happened in Connecticut took place, all the teachers are going, oh, look at this. It gets worldwide coverage. It's on the air nonstop. What about our kids in our neighborhoods right here, right now? The mayor of Chicago said, we need to have every school offer recess to children because it's healthy for them to be outside. Well, that might be the case for most kids. But if you are in Englewood, it is not safe. These teachers fought tooth and nail to keep this from happening. Three kids were shot within the first month. And another time, there was a man shooting someone, and the kids were just running with all their might into the building. My cousin Anna opened the doors. They ran in screaming and crying and fleeing to the floor and hiding until it was all over. And then they looked for their brothers and sisters. They knew the drill. They knew that they had to get out of the line of fire. And these teachers and these parents and these school administrators wonder, why aren't these children important? What makes these children of less value? It's because they're black, they're poor. Even before they enter school, Anna says 95% of these kids do not have a chance. So it's such a systemic problem that we refuse to face and deal with. It's not small. It's big. It's here. It's happening. Whew. I tell you, every time I get to the point of doing this service, I'm so excited about getting into it, and then I reach this impasse of despair. This place where I don't know how I'm going to bring this around. How will I make sense of this? How will I not bring people to the valley of the shadow of death and then help each other, all of us, to rise up so we can see what to do? And I often feel like, oh, it's just blah, 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 because it doesn't change. But I turn to the words of Martin Luther King, who still inspires from his deathbed. And remember, March 31st, 1968, in 4 days, this man was shot dead. Shot dead for speaking the truth. Shot dead for working for the elimination of poverty for all Americans. And to end violence in the world, to stop the war in Vietnam. And to eradicate racial injustice. On April 3rd, the day before he died, King delivered his "I Been to the Mountaintop" speech to a relatively small crowd that had braved bad weather to hear King speak. King's thoughts were obviously on his mortality, for he discussed the repeated threats on his life as well as the time he had been stabbed. He concluded with the speech with, "Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop, and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would love to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go to the mountaintop. And I've looked over and I've seen seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. We as a people will get to the promised land. And he also said something along these lines. He said that it takes every single person to exercise their will and to find ways to make a difference and not to stand on the sidelines letting everyone else do something. It may be something small. It may be something that seems insignificant, like Sandy helping the kids understand how to be inspired. It does not help to lay down in despair and not get up. It does not help. But it does help to recognize the truth, to look at our past leaders with open and clear eyes and understand they gave their best to their country and they lived in a time when thoughts and thinking were shaped in a much different way than they are today. But it is not to say that we dismiss the racism and the brutality that inflicted upon a whole race for 240 years. People will say to African Americans, why don't you just pick yourself up by the bootstraps? And Martin Luther King says, well, just think about it. If you were in prison and had been released because you had not actually committed the crime that you were said to be guilty of, you were released, but you got no boots, you got no ticket to the bus station, and you are supposed to make it. And then he goes on to talk about how European settlers, all of my great-grandparents who benefited from this in Kansas, were able to buy land cheaply. And not only were they able to buy land cheaply, but places like K-State rose out of the resources given to the state to build an institution of higher learning. He said, Martin Luther King said, was this made possible for the African Americans when the Emancipation Proclamation said, you're free? What were they to do? They were not skilled. They didn't know how to go out in the world and make a living on their own. They had been beaten. They had been battered. They had been abused. Their children were sold right in front of them. Their wives raped. So if you leave a people brutalized, how do you expect them to lift up and do the work they need to do to find their place in this society? So I'm back on my rant. I'm going to stop. So my advice is don't call my cousin Anna, because she says in the 20 years she's been teaching, it's worse. It is worse. It's not better, it is worse. So let us as a beloved community go forth into the world through a door of hope for the future, not only remembering these words by Martin Luther King. Even if I knew that tomorrow the world would go to pieces, I would still plant my apple tree. But also finding true ways of fulfilling the promise of our country by helping to live out our principles of respecting the inherent worth and dignity of each and every person and the interconnected web of existence of which we are all a part. We have a few moments for sharing, so if anybody has a brilliant solution to how to fix this, fulfill the promise that we're given.
I don't have a solution, but I think when you say that things are worse here, I think the way Obama was treated by the Republicans, by the radical right, this was rampant racism, and Englewood was always a hotbed, even though it had no violence at the time. It was always a hotbed of certainly they hated Jews and they hated blacks. And but there were no blacks, so nobody even talked about them. But it has always been this lower, it was a very mixed neighborhood. But it did have a majority were a lower middle class. And the lower middle class is not generous to its fellow man.
I don't know how well it would work, but we have resources of social media out there, you know, Facebook, Twitter, that type of thing. I think if we as a people start pushing out the true information that the media doesn't tell us, that eventually it's going to catch on and people are going to start waking up and realizing that it's more than just these middle class schools that are having these shootings, you know. It's more than the little suburbanites that are having these problems, that it's a problem within our country. You know, if we start using those resources and those tools to push out the information and say, hey, go here, read this, people will start waking up and realizing that the problem is our country as a whole.
Thank you. I think Harriet had her hand up.
One method of discrimination that I just learned about lately, it's been in the papers just in the last year, is that the government-sponsored loan agencies that were for farmers who couldn't get loans at banks discriminated against blacks and women by either finding some way to refuse them, or they would give them the loan after it was too late to plant their crops or too late to get the money to do whatever it was that they needed to do that year. And so they would, you know, lose an entire year of harvest. And they're just now admitting this and making these loans available.
Anna Franklin. Well, it's true that communication is important in getting the word out and getting people to understand what the truth is. But I also look around and I see that we have this wonderful service with beautiful music and a great sermon, and we're talking to ourselves. So I had the idea while Michael was talking that maybe a celebration on Martin Luther King Day that is a joint service between our church and one of the black churches in town would be something that we could think about, something like that. So
we have time for one more. Larry? Okay, then we have
just thinking of the gross inequality that has developed over the last 30 years in our country. And unless we do something about that, it's very unlikely that we're going to do anything about the racism that you're talking about. It would seem to me that developing much greater equality again in this country is a good beginning to begin then to have that reach down into the people who were least benefited at the moment.
All right, Sylvia, and then we'll have to close the sharing.
Well, Dick has really hit on a really important thing. If you just see the statistics about the imprisonment of black males, I mean, it's just absolutely shocking. Or also, we go berserk with this a rise in unemployment, but if you look in the inner cities, the unemployment of black males or black teenagers, I mean, it's not 8% or 5% like Manhattan. It's like 30% or even higher. It's really shocking. And I think there is there is a new trend in more honesty and information. Like, I'm assuming, did you read the Smithsonian article about Jefferson? Is that what incensed you so? And I read that too. And there is a program, I think it's on this Sunday, about abolitionists. My husband and I saw the first segment last week. That's absolutely shocking and riveting. And then there was one maybe last year called Slavery After the Civil War. That was also, these are all on PBS, which the kind of conservative elements trying to cut funding for PBS. But I mean, I see that as one of the few vehicles that's getting the information out. And I also wanted to say, I listened to a radio station on my computer, WBAI New York, and they have people of all colors doing the programming, and it is really eye-opening. There's particularly a man named Earl Caldwell, who is a very lauded black journalist who was in the Lorraine Motel when Martin Luther King was shot. He was never interrogated by the FBI, as were many other people there. There was some sort of a big cover-up there. He also was doing a story for the New York Times on the Black Panthers, and the FBI tried to force him to give up his sources, and he refused, and the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and he won, and his program's on Fridays. You can listen to him and any of the other good programming on WBAI and find out things that are happening in New York, which really are the same problems we have here. And I wanted to say that a number of years ago when I was actually program person, or maybe when I was chairperson, we did meet a couple years in a row with a black congregation, and it was hard. I mean, it was really hard. We found out what it was like to be a minority white face amongst a bunch of people of color, just how occasionally someone of color turns up in our congregation. And I mean, it's really hard to sustain something like that, and I think we should take on a suggestion and try to continue some sort of initiative like that.
Thank you, everyone, for sharing. There's much more to be said, but now it's time to sing our closing hymn, number 151, I Wish I Knew. seated for a moment. Can we? There we go. I'd like to share these closing words. We shall overcome. We shall overcome when we can truly celebrate the diversity of contributions and talents offered by all people. We shall overcome hatred and prejudice and oppression. When we can truly extend our hands to one another in loving acceptance, we shall overcome the past that haunts us now. Living in peace and freedom, we shall overcome the wrongs that have happened and the debts left unpaid. Let us join together in that commitment to overcome every form of hatred and injustice.
Hallelujah, Lord.